2015 welcomes in the 114th, but a grim detail cuts the 247 number to 246.
It was my understanding that there would be no math.
From WAMU 88.5 in Washington, I'm Ken Rudin, and this is The Political Junkie.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
And Ike to you, and Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us. Happy New Year, and welcome to episode 58 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The 114th Congress officially began on Tuesday with Republicans in control of both the House and Senate, though it's questionable if anyone can be in control of the Senate. John Boehner had about two dozen GOP defections, but it was not enough to deny him a third term as Speaker of the House. And he has a huge Republican majority behind him, 246 members. That's the most Republicans since the 1946 midterm elections when Harry Truman was president. Actually, they should have had 247 members, and that would have been the most since the 1928 elections. But they lost one on Monday when Michael Grimm, a Staten Island Republican, resigned from Congress after admitting he committed federal tax fraud. Lots of history in this Congress. 104 women. That's the most ever. One black female Republican, that's also the most ever. And we note, with the departures of Michigan's John Dingell and Texas's Ralph Hall, there are no longer any World War II veterans left in Congress. And, according to my research, this is the first time that's happened since before World War II. And speaking of departures, we lost Mario Cuomo, the former governor of New York, who's best remembered for his eloquent and passionate speech at the 1984 Democratic Convention. We also lost Edward Brooke, a Massachusetts Republican, who in 1966 became the first African-American ever popularly elected to the U.S. Senate. And we lost Bess Meyerson, whose career started as the first Jewish Miss America. She went on to be a longtime pal of New York City Mayor Ed Koch. She ran for the Senate in New York, and sadly, she ended up being embroiled in a bribery scandal. So much to catch up on since our last show, lots to talk about this week, and we'll get to it. But first, the trivia question. Pretty soon, the Senate will hold confirmation hearings for Ashton Carter to be Secretary of Defense. Carter would replace Chuck Hagel, the former senator from Nebraska. So the question is, who was the first former senator ever to become defense secretary? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. And I know what you're thinking. If Ashton Carter gets confirmed, will Charlie Sheen return to Two and a Half Men? Anyway, we'll give you the answer to last week's trivia question later in the show. So stay tuned. The 114th Congress has been sworn in, and Republicans are promising a new day. Mitch McConnell, the new majority leader, says the GOP won't be the party of no, that they'll show the American people they can work with the opposition and get things done. But both McConnell and returning House Speaker John Boehner have a similar problem. Opposition from President Obama, the Democrats, as well as with members of their own party, the Tea Party wing. Paul Kane covers Congress and politics for The Washington Post, and he's here to bring us up to speed on what happened this week and what we can look forward to from the 114th Congress. Paul, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
Hey, anytime, Ken.
There was a lot of politics in the House on the first day, especially this history note. 25 Republicans voted against Boehner for Speaker. That's the largest rebellion against a speaker since the Civil War, is that right?
Yeah, it's the largest against an incumbent speaker, certainly. There have been some other fights in the back in the 1920s that, if you added up the numbers, might be sort of similar. But those were battles for trying to pick a new speaker. And, you know, this is his third term in, and John Boehner still just can't shake the Tea Party. And they got more than 10% of the Boehner Republican caucus to oppose him. This is one of those votes where you can't rely on Democrats to bail you out because, you know, you're voting for your person. It's the most basic vote that you cast as a member of the House.
Well, here's just a little bit of that tape from Tuesday.
Honorable John A. Boehner of the state of Ohio has received 216 votes. The Honorable Nancy Pelosi of the state of California has received 164. And the Honorable Daniel Webster of the state of Florida has received 12. The Honorable Louis Gohmert of the state of Texas has received 3. The Honorable Ted S. Yoho of the state of Florida has received 2.
Well, you know, the reading clerk keeps saying the honorable. I'm wondering how honorable John Boehner thinks of them.
I know. It was a strange day because you had this group of, let's call them the Tea Party Republicans, and they have clashed with Boehner now for 4 years, and they've always been looking for somebody else to sort of take the reins, but they really don't have anyone else. It's a really odd leaderless group. And at the last minute, they all coalesced, well, half of them anyway, half of the 25, coalesced around a guy named Daniel Webster, who, despite his wonderful historic name of, you know, the 19th century congressional figure, he's actually kind of a moderate guy from suburban Orlando who has none of the Tea Party virtues or values that they have been touting for 4 to 6 years now. So it was just illogical, but it took root.
Aside from the fact that Dan Webster beat Alan Grayson at one point, he's probably a hero in that measure, but yeah. You're right. And so what's their argument? What's the Tea Party argument against Boehner?
Is that he is too collegial. He's too much of a go-along, get-along guy, that he's not willing to blow up the institutions of Washington in order to try to get his victories, that he's okay with incremental success. He doesn't speak loudly the way they do. If you turn on Fox News during the Sean Hannity show or listen to Rush Limbaugh, and, you know, we're in this era now where, you know, for some people on the far right and far left, what they want more than anything is just confrontation, loud, clashing confrontation.
And the fact that he allowed the funding of the Department of Homeland Security through the end of February, that didn't make them happy either, did it?
No, they didn't. You know, they see that as the sort of go-along, get-along type of guy. It was a compromise bill that included a lot of solid conservative wins on, you know, slashing EPA funding, cutting back, getting a provision to help Wall Street in terms of its modest repeals of portions of the Dodd-Frank law. There was a lot of that in this massive spending bill, but it didn't include the go to the gates and fight on Obama's immigration executive action that, you know, slowed deportations for millions and millions of undocumented immigrants. And because of that, they get angry and angry and more angry that there isn't the dramatic clash. There's no, you know, and they were willing to, you know, some of these guys were willing to shut down the government again over the fight on immigration, despite the fact that there were a bunch of other conservative victories in that large spending bill.
Well, if there was any kind of a clash this week, it was probably the fact that two of the Republicans who opposed Boehner have been booted off the Rules Committee. Here's what Boehner had to say about that on Wednesday.
We had a situation yesterday where we had to constitute the Rules Committee, but because of some of the activities on the floor, two of our members weren't put back on the committee immediately. I had not had a chance to talk to them. I had not had a chance to talk to our members. But this morning, I told the members the same thing I'm saying here. We're going to have a family conversation, which we had this morning, about bringing our team together.
And obviously the two people booted off Rules Committee were not part of the family, apparently.
Yeah, one of them being Webster and the other Congressman Nugent, both of Florida. You know, the Rules Committee is the speaker's entirely up to the Speaker. When you become Speaker of the House or you become Minority Leader, the people that you put on the Rules Committee are generally considered your most loyal soldiers, because they go into these meetings that set up the rules for debate on legislation, and they do whatever leadership essentially tells them to do. So if you got two guys on that committee who aren't willing to even vote for the Speaker, well, you know what happens? You're not on the Rules Committee anymore.
We saw in the 113th Congress, we saw a lot of legislation passed by the House, and then it was only to be bottled up in the Senate by the Democratic Majority Leader Harry Reid. Now, with the House and Senate presumably on the same page, there's now the thing they have to worry about is the Obama veto threat. That seems to be the thing that most the Republicans are now concerned with.
That's the big talk right now, you know, is the veto threat. Dick Durbin, the Senate Democratic whip, called it the ultimate safety play, the ultimate safety valve. But you still have to, on most legislation, they're still going to have to get through the Senate and get at least six, if not more, Democrats to overcome any sort of filibuster that would be led by Harry Reid and Democrats.
What issues do you think the two parties will be most combative?
Most combative, I think, will probably turn into the annual spending bills, the dozen bills that are supposed to pass one by one that fund the government and keep it open. And those are the ones that will have to, they're sort of the ultimate must-pass bills. And that's what McConnell is trying to coach his team to understand, that, you have to vote for these bills. And that's where they really want to tuck in provisions that might go after Obama's Cuba policy, where they can tuck in a provision that really goes after EPA regulations, and dare the Democrats to try to sort of block these things and potentially shut down little pieces of the government here or there over a simple fight about a rider that reins in the EPA. So that's probably going to be the biggest clash ahead.
Do we expect another obligatory vote on repealing the Affordable Care Act?
Yeah, there will be. There'll probably be a couple of them. There'll probably be some in the budget resolution that the House and Senate pass, but that's not actually a law. That's just sort of an outline of what you're going to try to do. But there's a lot of realism among the McConnell and Boehner operations. They sort of understand that you're just not going to get a wholesale root and branch repeal of Obamacare. It's just not going to happen.
I was going to say, you're not going to repeal Obamacare when you have a guy named Obama in the White House.
That is the line that Mitch McConnell has used over and over and over again to people when he tries to stress a realistic approach. Indeed.
I think he got it from me, actually, Paul. I think
whatever you said.
But there's some tinkering with the ACA that can be agreed on, right? The tax on medical devices or redefining the length of the work week. Is that possible? Are those possibles?
Well, that's the work week issue is one that's coming up pretty quickly. And the medical device one is sort of a fascinating one, because there are a couple dozen Senate Democrats. I mean, enough to override the veto. This is one where you really could see Democrats breaking away and actually overriding Obama's veto, because there are, I come from the suburban Philadelphia area, and in that area and across the Delaware River in New Jersey, there are plenty of people that are manufacturers of medical devices, heart valves, stents, those sort of things. Minnesota is another hotbed for the medical device industry. Right there, you have 2, 4, 6 Senate Democrats in those three states, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Minnesota, all of whom support repealing this medical device tax, because it is such a they see it as a thorn in the side to their local industry. And you could have upwards of 75 senators voting for that. It'll be interesting to see when Republicans play that card, because it seems to be the one most surefire victory that they could get.
Another issue where Democrats are seeming to split with the president is on there's a free trade bill that Obama and the Republicans seem to be on the same page. But the Democratic left, Elizabeth Warren, the Elizabeth Warren wing of the Democratic Party, they don't seem to be happy with that at all.
This is one that is going to play out And it's going to play out in both the Capitol and I think in presidential campaign politics, because Hillary Clinton, as a member of the Obama State Department in the first term, was actually supportive of these trade deals.
As was her husband when he was president.
And absolutely. You know, Bill Clinton negotiated NAFTA. But to most of the Democratic lawmakers here, they are an anathema. They think that it will lead to even fewer manufacturing jobs. And it is going to be a real sort of stress point. And McConnell talked about it Wednesday at the press conference, and he said he's not sure when. The first thing that he wants to bring forward is a trade promotion authority that sort of lays the groundwork to have these trade deals more quickly considered. And then there's the TPP, which is essentially this trade deal with what would account for 40% of the gross domestic product of the entire globe, with a lot of Asian, Southeast Asian nations, and the U.S. and South America. So that is something that would really irritate the Elizabeth Warren wing. It would irritate Harry Reid, the new minority leader, who, as of now anyway, is still running for re-election in 2016. He has been very anti-free trade and siding with unions on that matter. Obama, that's his real, that's his real moment of, does he want a bill that's a true legacy moment, even if it infuriates two-thirds of the Democratic base, or does he side with the far-left base for political reasons? It's a tricky landmine there for them.
Do you see the Democratic left being as tough on the president as the Tea Party is on McConnell and Boehner?
No, I don't think that's the case. I think there are some stark divisions on the left, but what we've seen in the last 5 years is clear that the far right is more angry at its so-called establishment than the far left is at the Democratic establishment. Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, despite, some concerns in some quarters of the left wing, they are still very popular figures. Whereas folks like John Boehner, John McCain, Mitch McConnell are not exactly at all liked by their far right base. But I think the more you see this play out in a new presidential campaign and you see the positions that a likely candidate Hillary Clinton takes, I think you begin to start to see some similar fissures. They might not be as openly toxic as they are on the Republican side, but they're going to play out and they're going to make people upset. And that's one of Mitch McConnell's goals, is to try and get legislation that might rein in the EPA a little bit here, that might pass trade deals that exposes some of those divides on the Democratic side.
As we were going through this list, I almost forgot. I forgot about the famous and always delightful debt ceiling fight coming up.
Yeah.
Will that always be with us? I mean, forever?
McConnell told me in an interview in his office just before Christmas that he does not – I mean, I've heard stuff from people that are saying that there's – certain Republican experts that are trying to lay the groundwork to create tax reform in exchange for raising the debt ceiling. But McConnell has pretty much said that he doesn't want to deal with this as an issue, that they're now in the majority, that they can set spending levels, they can reduce spending levels, that they have power now that they did not have in a divided Congress and that they did not have when they were completely out of power before that. And he says that, there's no reason to go to the moment of brinksmanship over the debt ceiling. Now, I don't know what that means. Does that mean that he's going to stand down and have Democrats pass the bill the way they did back in February of 2014? That might be the trick, where they just sort of say, all right, he's your president and you guys get to raise the debt ceiling. Or we could have, if that could be a real moment of revolt on his right flank, and we could be back where we were in some of these other pesky fights that sort of take us to the brink of something bad and gets Wall Street all jittery.
And there's also the prospect that 40 to 45 members of the Senate will be running for president in 2016, so there's always that.
Yeah, there always is. There always is. Every 4 years, the number of senators who wake up every morning and see a future president in the mirror, well, it's just about 98 or 99, I assume.
And we'll worry about 2015 before we worry about 2016.
Indeed.
Paul Kane covers Congress and politics for The Washington Post. He can be found on Twitter at PK Capital. Paul, thanks a lot for being on the show.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
And we wouldn't want to leave you without talking about some of the really interesting stuff going on in the Senate, and that means Vice President Joe Biden. Biden, whose job it is to swear in members every session, also did something extra. He was Bidening. At the ceremonial swearing-in, he snapped selfies, he kissed babies, he called grandmas, he told little kids the whole thing was boring. Let's listen to some of the highlights.
Dick!
Vice President?
How are you, pal?
Thanks for swearing out.
I tell you what, easy to swear at you. Thaddeus, best guy in the United States Senate.
Oh,
you got some eyes, kid. I like kids better than people.
Oh, man, this is boring, boring, boring.
Isn't this boring, boring, boring?
Charlie, this is boring. Come on.
I'll tell you what, man, I may be Irish, but I'm not stupid.
Well, let's do it again. I'll look where I'm supposed to.
Joe Biden has two more years as vice president. I think we have to figure out to keep him on in some capacity because he is just too good of copy. One of the items on the new Senate's to-do list will be confirming President Obama's choice of Ashton Carter for Secretary of Defense. Carter is a former deputy defense secretary whose expertise in the Pentagon goes back to the Clinton administration. He is thought to be more opinionated and more aggressive than the man he will replace, Chuck Hagel. The knock on Hagel is that he was never really part of the president's inner circle. He was said to be passive and quiet during cabinet meetings. He also questioned the Obama strategy in Syria and Iraq, and that didn't go over too well with the White House. He was also often shut out of foreign policy decisions. In the history of the Defense Department, what Hagel went through was not unusual. Charles Stevenson knows all about this stuff. He's a lecturer on foreign policy at Johns Hopkins University, an expert on national security, and the author of SecDef, The Nearly Impossible Job of Secretary of Defense. Charlie Stevenson, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thank you, Ken.
A lot was expected of Chuck Hagel when he joined the cabinet, even though he went through this rocky confirmation. Obama loved the fact that he was independent in the Senate. He broke from the Republican Party on Iraq. He served in Vietnam. And I think I thought maybe perhaps that by being a former Republican, they thought maybe he can get along well with Republicans in Congress, although most Republicans voted against him. What ultimately ended Hagel's tenure?
Well, I think he became a political problem for the president and wasn't working out well. He didn't help the president politically on Capitol Hill, though he was a Republican, for the reasons that you mentioned. And you know, for whatever reason, I guess the president and he just fell out of the sync that they'd been in earlier.
Well, you know everything about the history of the Secretaries of Defense. Can you be an independent Secretary of Defense, especially in an administration that relies on a close circle of advisors?
I think that's probably a false charge against Hagel and in this situation. Every White House wants to control its cabinet members, including, of course, the Secretary of Defense. So I don't think that the charge of micromanaging is really the major issue between Hagel and the White House. Yeah, I think it has to be deeper and broader than that.
Well, but we kept hearing about that he didn't get along with Susan Rice. He had misgivings about the Syria policy, the Iraq policy.
To be successful, a Secretary of Defense needs to maintain good relations with four different constituencies. Most important is the president, and I think that's where Hagel eventually fell out of favor with President Obama.
Even though they were kind of allies in the Senate together, correct?
Yes. Yeah. But, you know, presidents have to be right. Harsh and usually are. Even if they don't do the firing, they usually reach that understanding. The reason I wrote the book, by the way, because I was shocked to discover that basically a third of the secretaries of defense have been fired or forced to resign. Somehow that's not a career-enhancing job for most of them.
It's nothing like Secretaries of State. Nobody gets fired, well, unless you're Alexander Haig, but nobody gets fired if you're Secretary of State.
I looked at the history. There are only two Secretaries of State who've been fired in 220-some years. Haig was one, and one in the Washington administration was the other. But Secretaries of Defense, about a third of them have been fired. Anyway, to be successful, the Secretary of Defense needs good relations with the president, good relations with the Congress, good relations with the senior military, and good relations with his National Security Council teammates, the Secretary of State, CIA director, and those people. I think Hagel had fair relations with the military and only mediocre relations with the Congress, probably okay relations with his the Secretary of State. But if the president wasn't happy with him, then he couldn't stay very long.
I remember after the 2006 elections, President Bush got rid of Donald Rumsfeld. And, of course, Iraq was one of the reasons that the Republicans did so poorly in the 2006 elections, and Rumsfeld was an easy target. With the rise of the Islamic State, with what's going on with Putin and Ukraine, and there's so much criticism of the president's foreign policy and national security policy, was Hagel blamed for this? Did people think Hagel was responsible? Was he a scapegoat?
Well, certainly the public didn't blame Hagel. Yeah. The Congress didn't blame Hagel. I don't know what the inner circle of the White House, including the president, thought about him, though. They had obviously more opportunities to see him, to listen to his advice, to see his reactions, and that may have been a factor. We just don't know. Most secretaries of defense who leave under a cloud, like Hagel, like Rumsfeld, when they leave, they get patted on the back, and they usually wait a while before the inside story of who really stabbed whom starts to come out.
The tell-all book.
Yes.
Yeah. Is it important? I mean, a lot of the things we've read that he didn't get along with Susan Rice, they had differing views, things like that. And obviously, if you're president, as you say, you want to have somebody on your team. But is it important for the president to hear dissenting views? And I think the reason I ask that, if I think of Iraq, and for the most part, in the second term at least, George W. Bush relied on Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz and Condoleezza Rice, and they were all on the same page on Iraq. Is it good to have somebody who says, wait a minute, Mr. President, you're not looking at it this way or that way?
Well, I think it's good for cabinet members to be honest and to speak truth to power. I don't know that you could say you ought to have a devil's advocate in a job because the devil's advocate too quickly becomes just the devil.
That brings me to your book, SecDef. I love that sector, which is Secretary of Defense. The Nearly Impossible Job of Secretary of Defense. Why is it nearly impossible?
Because there are so many issues that only a Secretary of Defense can really decide, and he's running a huge bureaucratic organization. And yet the Secretary has to be a war planner, he has to be a manager, he has to acquire new weapons, he has to build up the morale of the forces and of the civilians who are working for him, and he has to be a diplomat, traveling around the world doing diplomatic chores, and he has to, of course, advise the president and the National Security Council.
It sounds like there's a lot of work.
All of those jobs, and it's very hard for any one person to be very skilled and knowledgeable and for each of those roles.
I was going to say, with all those roles and responsibilities, it sounds like a lot of overtime, a lot of work to be done, right? What does history tell us about secretaries of defense in the past, how in the successful ones, the unsuccessful ones, how do you see it?
Well, as I say, about a third of them have been fired or forced to resign. So ultimately, a lot of them just cannot succeed in the job. And most of them who've been fired or forced to resign haven't suffered that because they mismanaged the Pentagon. It's because they failed in those other outside of the Pentagon jobs with the Congress the president, the White House people.
I think of Robert McNamara during Vietnam, for example.
Yes. He actually lost confidence in the war he was fighting, and the president lost confidence in him as a result. But it's just very hard for a secretary has to pick and choose which battles to fight, McNamara said at one point, I can slay only so many dragons each day. And if they pick their priorities right and they focus on what's important to them and to the biggest challenges they face and to the White House, they'll do okay. If they stumble in that, then they're probably going to be ousted.
From my understanding or from my reading of it, it seemed like Donald Rumsfeld was had a good relationship with Bush, and they were maybe on the same page with the president on the war, but just that the war was so unpopular that somebody had to pay the price.
He may have been a scapegoat in that sense, but I think Bush in his second term did start listening to people other than Cheney and Rumsfeld, and they did suggest things, changes of policy, such as the a troop surge in Iraq, that a lot of the people there in positions of power didn't even agree with. Actually, Rice and the Joint Chiefs of Staff didn't agree with the surge. That was sold to Bush by other people, but he decided it was the right policy, and the people who were on the other side had to accept it.
I was going through your book, and of course, I was struck by the chapter on Les Aspin, who was, I think, President Clinton's Secretary of Defense for 15 minutes or something like that. He was chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. He was well versed in foreign policy, but by all accounts, he was an absolute disaster.
Well, I think the best take on Aspin, whom I knew and liked as a person, as a congressman.
He died young, didn't he?
He also had some health problems, too, even when he was secretary. He really was too much a congressman. He didn't have executive experience, and he didn't have kind of the skills that warriors like, such as decisiveness. He was too nerdy. I point out, it's interesting, there are only two people up until Ash Carter, who will be the third, who really were groomed for being Secretary of Defense, who really were defense intellectuals, Jim Schlesinger and Les Aspin, and both failed. They couldn't perform the other jobs besides understanding defense issues. Ash Carter is a defense intellectual. He has a lot of inside the Pentagon experience, so he could be a good Secretary of Defense. On the other hand, the past record of how those defense intellectuals do in those positions isn't very encouraging.
If Ash Carter reads your book, can I assume that he's not going to be too optimistic about his future?
He probably, if he's smart, he won't even think about those things.
Well, can you be a politician and be Secretary of Defense? A politician is always, obviously most politicians seem to be less decisive and more, well, let me weigh this on one hand or the other hand.
I think it's a difference between the executive and legislative branches. People who've served in Congress are deal makers and compromisers, and they know that timing is important, both to wait for the right time to do something or to seize opportunities that arise. They're good at compromise. In the executive branch and former governors, they know they do have to make decisions, and quicker decisions are better than delayed decisions. And that personality type, I think, does better in the executive branch than former legislators.
Although in your book, you gave Melvin Laird, who's the longtime congressman from Wisconsin, who was President Nixon's first defense secretary, you give him pretty high marks.
I think he's one of the unsung heroes, along with Bill Perry, Clinton's second secretary of defense.
Who was never in public office.
Never in public office. Because Laird understood mega politics and was able to be decisive. He was able to challenge the Nixon White House. He worked out a good arrangement with the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He gave them military modernization in exchange for their support for his winding down the Vietnam War. So that was a kind of a mega political deal that Laird pulled off despite pressures from lots of directions, the Congress, the White House, even some of the chiefs. But he did it by getting the chiefs on board with his modernization plan. So that worked.
We all love to make lists, the greatest president ever, the greatest baseball player ever, the greatest movie ever. Who tops your list as the best Secretary of Defense ever?
Bob Gates. I think, first he kept the confidence of two quite different presidents.
Two different parties.
of different parties through an extended two-war situation. And so the ability to maintain the confidence of the president says a lot about him. But he was more than that. I think he had the confidence of the Congress. They gave him the budgets that he asked for. He had the confidence of the senior military. And I think he worked well with both secretaries of state in the two different administrations. So he checked all of those boxes that I say are important. And I think he did something else. He had a good sense, a good strategic sense. He forced the Pentagon to get out of their long-term vision and deal with the two wars they were fighting. He talked about the presentitis. He wanted the Pentagon to deal with the wars they were fighting that day, that month, that year, whereas institutionally they're organized to think long-term, and they were thinking so long-term they weren't taking care of the troops that were in danger in Iraq and Afghanistan at the time. So he pushed things like the MRAP transportation vehicle that the military didn't really want because they didn't think it was important for the long run.
Charlie Stevenson is a longtime national security expert and the author of SecDef, The Nearly Impossible Job of Secretary of Defense. Charlie, it was great having you on the show.
Thank you.
It's time for This Week in Political History. History was made during this week in 2004. For the first time since 1948, a presidential debate was held that was on radio only. It ran on NPR, and it was co-sponsored by WOI in Des Moines, and it included six of the nine Democrats running that year: former Vermont Governor Howard Dean, Congressman Dick Gephardt of Missouri and Dennis Kucinich of Ohio, former Senator Carol Moseley Braun of Illinois, and the eventual nominee, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry. And it was hosted by NPR's Neil Conan. There were no cameras. There was no live audience. It was actually pretty civil. If you look for debates, for the gaffes, for the gotcha moments, well, this wasn't your cup of tea. That's not the way Neil operated. The two-hour debate was held at Iowa State University in Des Moines 11 years ago this week, on January 6th, 2004. And Neil Conan is here to tell the tale. Hi, Neil.
Hey, Ken. How are you?
Good. I miss you.
I miss you, too.
And listen, don't tell me about the weather in Hawaii, because somehow I hang up on you when you do that.
It's pretty nice, Ken.
Okay. This was the first presidential radio debate since Thomas Dewey and Harold Stassen, when they squared off in 1948, right before the crucial Oregon primary. Neil, you were there at that 48 debate. How did it compare to the one in Iowa?
Well, Stassen almost made it to this debate, too, but he eventually stopped running. You mentioned in your introduction, actually, one of the key things about it. There was no audience. The only people in the room there at Iowa State were myself, Brendan Banaszak, our director, tech, and the candidates. They were the only people in the room. And these guys were so used to, and Carol Moseley Braun, were so used to playing to audiences, it took them a while to stop going to applause lines and not hearing any applause.
I'm used to not hearing applause because I do this show every week. But I just remembered being very serious, very civil. By the way, they're applauding behind the glass right here. They're doing it to be obnoxious. But I just remembered being very civil, very thoughtful, and very filled with information that you don't get in the gotcha soundbite kind of stuff you hear in normal debates.
It was a real pleasure to do it. And once they recognized the setting they were in, I think everybody got pretty darn serious. And one thing that we did a lot on Talk of the Nation, and one thing we focused a lot on in that program, was on foreign policy.
Well, yeah, before we get to the actual things, I want to know how you prepared for it. I mean, what preparation did you have to do for this? How many debates did you have to sit through and listen? How many policy papers did you need to read? What was going on in the country that people needed to know about?
Well, you know, the fact is that in the course of doing Talk of the Nation every day, I was pretty well prepared to do it anyway. I did get big policy briefing books on each of the candidates who were there and on each of the candidates who weren't there. One of the things we were really concerned about was getting critical mass, enough candidates to agree to appear to make it a credible debate. In the end, we got six, and including the two biggies who were Senator Kerry and Howard Dean, then the front runner for the nomination. In an odd sort of way, you know, I don't want to make too big a deal of it, but it was a moment where John Kerry started turning things around and Howard Dean started trending down a little bit. And the moment the campaign changed, I don't know, but it was right around that moment.
Right. I think, as I recall, it was like 2 weeks to go before the actual the caucuses, correct?
I think exactly. And that was followed by Howard Dean's famous scream. Well, he was next heard from as the chairman of the Democratic Party.
You mentioned foreign policy. That obviously with the Iraq war in high gear in 2004, that was a clear issue. What do you remember about foreign policy in that debate?
Well, it was a huge issue because you had what kind of Democratic Party was it going to be? Was it going to be a party that was going to be lining up behind the president in the Iraq war, as many, you know, mainstream Democrats had done? We had representing that branch of the party, certainly Joe Lieberman on that debate crew, and John Kerry going sort of back and forth, but eventually pretty much supporting a United States effort in the war in Iraq, and Howard Dean highly critical, and Dennis Kucinich even more so.
You know, what resonates with me, and I was listening to the debate last night, and I was just thinking, 11 years later, the countries that they talked about in the debate were Pakistan, North Korea, and Iraq, and that topped the foreign policy. I mean, as if the debate were held yesterday, or today even, what am I saying? Here's John Kerry on Pakistan.
The specter of an Islamic radical state with nuclear weapons is unacceptable for the world. And that is what is at risk in Pakistan today. I believe that you have to walk a very fine line, but I am convinced we can be tougher with Pakistan. There are steps that we could take now to deal with the northwest component where Osama bin Laden is. We know he's up there. We have not pushed hard enough.
Okay, and here's Howard Dean on North Korea.
As we sit here, the president of the United States is refusing to have bilateral negotiations with the North Koreans, who almost certainly have a bomb already. This president is about to allow North Korea to become a nuclear power. The danger in that is not that the North Koreans will immediately attack us. The real danger is that they will do what Pakistan is accused of. They'll sell that weaponry to terrorists or to other countries like Libya or Pakistan for hard currency. That is a major national security threat, and this president is not defending this country the way he ought to be by refusing to engage in those kinds of deliberations.
And here's Dennis Kucinich on Iraq.
What credibility do we have as a nation trying to teach peace when we're involved in a war against Iraq at this very moment, in the ongoing occupation, in trying to control the oil and privatize the country? The way that we teach peace is through example. We need to set aside policies of unilateralism and preemption. And we need to engage the world fearlessly and confidently once again. Not the America of duct tape and plastic, but the America of Francis Scott Key's Land of the Free, Home of the Brave.
You know, Neil, I listened to those segments, those excerpts from the debate. As I said, we could have heard that in today's debate.
Well, except for the duct tape and plastic, who remembers that? And of course, we all know that Osama bin Laden, well, it turns out he was in the northwest corner of Pakistan.
You know, Neil, in the years since the debate, you and I have talked about this, something that Dennis Kucinich did that I think we both agree. Hey, you already know what I'm going to do. It has to be the highlight of the debate. Let's give it a listen.
I don't see how in the world, when you have something that at this point takes up about 50% of the discretionary budget of this country.
Congressman Kucinich is holding up a pie chart, which not truly 50, effective on the radio.
50%. Well, it's effective if Howard can see it.
He held up a pie chart in a radio debate.
Well, this was part of his standard routine when he was on television and in other debates. And he did it. I think he had a bigger version of it when he made speeches and such. But he might want to have adapted that for radio.
Where does that rate in your list of favorite on-air moments? It has to be up there.
It's got to be one of them. It is. I just couldn't quite believe it. And the only thing I was concerned about afterwards was, had I called him Congressman Kucinich? And indeed, I was fortunate enough to have remembered to do that.
Yeah, well, every time I think of that pie chart on a radio debate, I think of you. And I remember, I think, as I recall, I was sitting outside of a glass something watching you, and I was watching your face, and I'm thinking, oh, Neil is loving every moment of this.
Well, I have in front of me, in fact, a piece of cardboard that's big, oh, I guess about 18 inches long, 6 inches high, signed by Howard Dean, Joe Lieberman, Dick Gephardt, Carol Moseley Braun, John Kerry, and Dennis Kucinich, a memento from that radio-only presidential debate in 2004.
You know, later in the show, we're going to talk about the legacy, I guess, of Mario Cuomo, who died on January 1st. We're going to hear from his famous 1984 convention speech in San Francisco. But you tell me, you have a great Mario Cuomo story.
Well, I grew up in New York City, and I was a reporter in New York before I came down to Washington to work for NPR. And this was on a show called RVR Evening at a radio station, WRVR, that was in a distant corner of Manhattan at 120th Street and Riverside Drive. This was so long ago, the name of the host of the show was Bob Siegel.
and whatever happened to
anyway,
him?
Anyway, yeah, I don't know. Mario Cuomo came by. He was then Secretary of State for New York State under, I guess, Hugh Carey.
It was Hugh Carey, yep.
And he had just written a book about his experiences in Forest Hills and was on to do a book interview. Anyway, at the end of the show, as Secretary of State, was the most minor job you can imagine in New York. I think he signed, you know, the barbershop permits. But it did entitle him to a town car and a driver. And he's on his way out of the studio, and he sticks his head back and he says, "Anybody need a ride to Queens?" Well, I lived in Queens at the time, so I said, "Sure." And so, you know, instead of taking, you know, 3 trains and a bus out to my place in Kew Gardens Hills, I got to ride with the Secretary of State of New York in his town car. And it turned out to be one of any number of conversations, long conversations, I was lucky to have with Mario Cuomo in the back of his various cars in various moments as he was campaigning for one thing or another. Later mayor of New York, of course, later governor of New York. I covered all those campaigns. What a gentleman he was. What a smart man he was. But you know what we talked about mostly on that trip, Ken?
Let me guess. Baseball?
Baseball. Yeah, he used to play shortstop, minor league shortstop, and he had the hands of a shortstop, too.
I don't remember Cuomo mentioning that incident, that ride with you, in that convention speech in San Francisco.
Well, I'm sure it was the next thing he was going to say.
But it was an amazing speech at the convention, wasn't it?
It was a great speech. What a great speaker he was.
Neil Conan is the former host of Talk of the Nation on NPR, and more important, my sometimes buddy on our political junkie road trips around the country. Neil, we had some great trips in 2014 in Fairbanks, in Rochester, and Cincinnati. Hopefully, we'll have a lot more in 2015.
Maybe even to Hawaii, Ken. Who knows?
By car. It was 11 years ago this week, on January 6, 2004, when Neil Conan hosted an all-radio presidential debate in Iowa. And as you can see, I'm holding up a sign that says, "Thank you, Neil Conan, for being on the show again."
Thanks, Ken.
You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. It's time to reveal the answer and winner of our last trivia question, which was, a lot has to happen first, but there is the possibility of a Jeb Bush versus Hillary Clinton presidential race next year. The question was, when was the last time relatives of elected politicians ran against each other as the major party candidates for president? The answer, 2000, when George W. Bush, son of former President George H.W. Bush, ran against Al Gore, son of former Tennessee Senator Albert Gore Sr.
We are almost out of time, so I will instead ask each candidate to sum up in a single word the best argument for his candidacy. Governor Bush?
Strategery.
Vice President Gore.
Lockbox.
And the winner is Nancy Brennan of Minneapolis. Nancy gets the coveted political junkie button. And the last scuttle button puzzle winner? The first button read, Gene McCarthy, 68. That was followed by a Gil Carmichael for governor button from Mississippi. And then there was an all the way with LBJ button. And that, at least in my mind, adds up to Jingle All the Way. And Santa brings the political junkie button to Bunny Salter of Cumming, Georgia. I'm guessing Santa was coming a little late this year. As always, check out our website for the latest campaign updates, scuttlebutt puzzles, political columns, trivia questions, and more. It's at krpoliticaljunkie.com. Mario Cuomo died last week. He was the former three-term governor of New York who gave one of the most powerful speeches in convention history. He was the keynote speaker at the Democratic National Convention in San Francisco in 1984, and he gave a stirring rebuttal to President Ronald Reagan's depiction of America as a shining city on a hill. Here's an excerpt.
Mr. President, you ought to know that this nation is more a tale of two cities than it is just a shining city on a hill. Maybe, Mr. President, if you visited some more places, maybe if you went to Appalachia where some people still live in sheds, maybe if you went to Lackawanna where thousands of unemployed steel workers wonder why we subsidize foreign steel. Maybe, Mr. President, if you stopped in at a shelter in Chicago and spoke to the homeless there. Maybe, Mr. President, if you asked a woman who had been denied the help she needed to feed her children because you said you needed the money for a tax break for a millionaire or for a missile we couldn't afford to use.
It was eloquent, it was passionate, it was forceful. And it propelled Mario Cuomo to the top of the wish list of those who wanted a Democrat in the White House. But he couldn't or wouldn't commit. After the 1984 election, when the Democrats and Walter Mondale lost to President Reagan in a 49-state landslide, the clamor for Cuomo to run was intense. But in the end, he said no. And again, after 1988, when Michael Dukakis became the fifth Democrat in the last six elections to lose the presidential election, again Democrats pleaded with Cuomo to come to their rescue. Joe Grandmaison was one of those Democrats moved by Mario Cuomo. He was the chairman of the Democratic Party in New Hampshire, site of the first in the nation primary. He was ready to back the New York governor for 1992. It was a very exciting time. This story is vintage Cuomo, and no one is better equipped to tell it than Joe Grandmaison. Joe, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I have to tell you, when I first heard of Mario Cuomo's death on New Year's Day, you were the first person I thought of to come on this program and talk about the 1992 Cuomo for President campaign that never was. And I'm thinking of that December day in 1991, the deadline to get on the New Hampshire presidential primary ballot. A plane is about to take him from Albany to Concord. You were waiting there in Concord. Tell us what happened.
Well, I had been contacted by John Marino, who is the party chairman in New York State, to see if I would be supportive of the governor. And I said I would be and went about on their direction, organizing some beginnings so that he could come up here and file for his candidacy. You don't have to physically do it yourself. If you could have somebody do it in your place. However, it makes people feel good, for those of us in New Hampshire, if you prioritize it and do come up and file for president yourself. And then we just set up a platform in front of the State House and waited for him to arrive.
Now, that was 23 years ago. You're still waiting there. Is that correct?
Well, you know, one of the things that's happened, I mean, it turned into a major media event. I mean, it was ridiculous. You turn on CNN, and for hours, it seemed like hours they had pictures of the plane. You know, it deserved attention. I'm not quite sure there's that much attention, but I found in the past few days, particularly since the funeral, just earlier this week, that the question as to why he didn't run was finally, to my satisfaction, at least answered by Governor Andrew Cuomo, saying he just didn't want to be president, period. Not a bad reason.
Well, that's what you found out 23 years later from Andrew Cuomo. But go back to that day in 1991. I mean, I remember it like it was yesterday, and I assume you remember it well, too. Walk us through your thought processes. You're waiting for the plane to arrive. The plane never arrives. You go home, and what? You, what happens when you get home?
Well, you know, as you would expect when you stop planning a campaign like that, first of all, it was remarkably easy to get people to want to join this small group of people who are beginning this effort. Friends, you know, when they heard about it, would call and volunteer to help, that sort of thing. And we had a good turnout of people with no notice whatsoever standing in front of the State House. I was obviously disappointed. But again, you know, there's not much you can say. I mean, what Governor Cuomo at that time explained that he felt he had a commitment to the citizens of New York that was his priority, and they didn't have a state budget, and he should pay attention to that. Now, he's classified, you know, you hear that he was indecisive. I'm not so sure that's the case. He decisively said no. Having a different opinion than the rest of us who weren't, you know, minimally involved compared to his need to really, as you know, Ken, in order to be successful in a campaign, much less in a presidential campaign, you have to go for the jugular. You have to really go out and push. He just didn't have that need, that driving need that most politicians have.
Well, you say he was decisive, but he waited until 90 minutes before the filing deadline. So that was decisive. It was a decisive no. But, I mean, there was until then, there was a lot of teasing, a lot of, well, I may run, I may not run. He waited till 90 minutes before the deadline. I mean, that's how I used to prepare for tests in college, but but I wasn't running for president.
Well, but what he was preparing for it in his own head. I mean, he thought about virtually everything, is what I'm told, to a great degree. That's not bad in a president. May not be great in a candidate in the sense of getting them to make that commitment. But he's not the first individual. There's another, you know, Senator Rockefeller, when he considered running for president, called the night before just to say that he thought it through and reached a determination he just didn't have that. Wasn't able to lay out the vision that he would want to do were he a candidate. I think to some degree, conceivably, Governor Cuomo was in the same situation.
Of course, very few Democrats, let alone of any party, had the kind of vision that we heard from Mario Cuomo at that San Francisco convention.
Oh, just the replay of pieces of that convention speech over the past weekend have reminded you. I mean, he was... The text that he used, the words, the passion, it seemed to be as relevant today as they were back then.
You know, he always talked about you campaign in poetry, but you govern in prose. That was clearly poetry in San Francisco in 1984. You ever wonder what, you know, I mean, I spend a lot of time thinking about what ifs. What if he ran? Would he have been a good candidate? And what if he had won? Would he have been a good president? What do you think?
Well, I think the only thing we have to go by is three successful runs for governor of the Empire State. So obviously he had the leadership quality. Unfortunately, over the course, it would appear as to people with far less capacity or intellectual and otherwise now seem to run for president at the drop of a hat.
Could he have won in New Hampshire? Could he have won the primary? I mean, we always talk about Bill Clinton, but Bill Clinton actually lost the primary. Remember, he was the comeback kid against Paul Tsongas. But Cuomo would have been a different kind of candidate than New Hampshire voters would have seen that year.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, we locals who were supporting him, I assume, would have been encouraging him to as much as was practical, run a retail campaign, which are the ones that are usually successful here in New Hampshire. That's difficult when you're the front runner or when your crowds are, when you're not given the opportunity to talk to people in small groups.
Mario Cuomo was a liberal, and he wore that label proudly. But the party moved in a different direction in 1992 when they picked Bill Clinton, and who campaigned more like a centrist. And now we have about 2 years to go with the Barack Obama presidency. There are some in the party who look back wistfully to Cuomo's passion, his defense of liberal policies and ideals. Is there a Mario Cuomo on the horizon? Do you see one?
Well, I'm not quite sure the times are so in tune. It's going to be interesting to see. I personally obviously will be supporting Senator Clinton, Secretary Clinton, and I'm confident that in her campaign that she'll lay out her course of what she sees for the future. It's just different is what it comes down to. Cuomo also had a great advantage in that he was running against in that speech. It was focused and aimed at Ronald Reagan. And in some respects, you don't have to be terribly liberal to be able to draw the distinction between yourself and Reagan.
Joe Grandmaison is the former chair of the New Hampshire Democratic Party. He's currently with the PR and lobbying firm of APCO Worldwide. Joe, it was great having you on the show.
Take care. Thank you.
And if you want to read more about Cuomo, well, you can read my column on the what ifs of Cuomo's presidential run at USA Today. We've got a link to that story on the Political Junkie Facebook page and on Instagram. And if you don't have a computer, just call me and I'll read you my column over the phone. And we wanted to take a moment to remember a couple of other political figures who died this week. Edward Brooke, a Republican senator from Massachusetts, died on January 3rd. Brooke was the first African-American popularly elected to the U.S. Senate. His election in 1966 was not a big surprise. He was already serving as Massachusetts Attorney General and was a well-known figure in the state. After serving two terms, he was defeated by Paul Tsongas in 1978, an election that was decided more on the aftermath of an ugly divorce that Brooke went through than anything else. One of our listeners, Richard Johnson, is a Ph.D. student at Oxford University and might have sat in on the last interview of Brooke's life.
It was deeply moving to speak to a man who could share memories about his grandfather, who'd been born a slave, life in segregated Washington, D.C., writing a letter of recommendation to Martin Luther King, who'd been in the same fraternity as him, being elected the first African-American to statewide office in the 20th century, being the first U.S. politician to go to Cambodia after it broke off diplomatic relations with the United States, being instrumental in the passing of the Fair Housing Act, facing down Richard Nixon over Watergate, the list goes on. I think Brooke has been unfairly described as a black senator who didn't think much about black issues. While Brooke didn't limit himself to exclusively black politics, he was proud of his racial identity and I think profoundly aware of the burden of history. In his autobiography, he wrote that when he was being sworn in as a senator in 1967, he thought to himself, quote, would I let my race down and prove the bigot's right? Much of Brooke's civil rights work remains little known because it was often behind the scenes. As the years went on, obviously, the Republicans drifted further away from Brooke's sort of progressive liberal Republicanism. He said that he never regretted being a Republican. I'd asked him, though, if he voted for Barack Obama in the 2008 and 2012 presidential elections. He said that he had. Ultimately, I will not forget the interest that he showed to young doctoral students in the last year of his life. In many ways, I believe a testament to the sort of man his colleagues said he was.
That was Richard Johnson, a Ph.D. student at Oxford University, remembering the hours he spent with Edward Brooke, who died this week at the age of 95. And we also learned this week about the death of Bess Meyerson. She deserves mention on this show because of her political activities, but there was also much more to her than just politics. She was the first Jewish Miss America. She was a fixture on Ajax commercials, the lady in mink on The Big Payoff. She was also a panelist on game shows like The Name's the Same. In this piece of tape, she's trying to figure out a famous name, not knowing it's her own.
Are you primarily an actress?
No.
Are you perhaps famous for singing or playing a musical instrument?
No, I'm not.
Let's see now. You don't sing, act, or play a musical instrument. Sound like you don't do anything.
Meyerson was also active in political causes. She was appointed to the Consumer Affairs Office under New York City Mayor John Lindsay and helped push through one of the toughest consumer protection laws in the country. She was Ed Koch's constant companion when he was elected mayor in 1977, a role, some whispered, that she took to deflect questions about Koch's sexuality. She also ran for the U.S. Senate in 1980, losing the Democratic primary to Elizabeth Holzman. But later in life, she was the source of tabloid fodder for her divorces, bribery accusations, affairs, and even shoplifting. The irony is that for someone who spent so much of her life in the public eye, she died without any fanfare. We only learned of her death now because we saw it in a coroner's record. That's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is made possible by the generous folks at WAMU 88.5 in Washington and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. For political columns, trivia questions, scuttlebutt puzzles, and bad jokes, check out our website at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or shoot us a message on Facebook. Just search for The Political Junkie. Our producer and editor is A.D. Quigg. Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and webmaster, and Alex Drewinskis is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. Hope your new year is off to a great start. I'll see you next week.